All right, we're gonna start recording. So if you want to do a cheer, you can cheer now. Thank you.
You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Foz Mamoon, and Seth Miller.
This is episode 600 of Dots, Lines, and Destinations. I'm Stephen Seagraves, joined today by Mr. Foz Mamoon and Seth Miller.
And the entirety of Points Travel Festival Portland.
Yeah. For this special episode, 600, which is not really 600, but it is 600.
We don't really count.
Yeah.
Well,
that's true. We're not good at math. or points.
So the history of how we met was Flyer Talk, really was the center of that.
Yeah.
And the Continental dude. Foz and I were both big Continental flyers.
I was too. I was a Newark guy.
And we went to the Continental Do in Houston. I think that's how we first all met, right?
Right. So should we talk about what the Continental Do's are?
Yeah. Explain it.
So way back when, there was a bet between Larry Kellner and a gentleman, Dean Burry, who went as Cigar Man on Flyer Talk.
CEO of Continental and Dean.
Yeah. And Larry Kellner was the CEO of Continental. And they had they made a bet that Larry didn't believe he could get 1,000 people or a couple hundred people to show up on their own dime to hang out with the airline.
It was like 100. It wasn't even hard.
And little did they know that they oversold very, very quickly. And so it was great. They opened all the doors. You got to see the back end operations. And they ended up doing 4 of these through the lifespan of the program. And we got to go to the bunker, which is where they have their where they have a call center in case all hell breaks loose, where they can move staff, operations, and everything to continue running the airline. We did a charter flight, which was phenomenal because it was on the 75, and they just went straight up when we took off. That was a pretty cool experience. But we went to these 4 of these, and we all became friends over time.
Yeah. And then you were on the Upgrade podcast.
I was on the Upgrade
podcast. And that's a podcast that went away.
A long time ago.
And we were talking about we should start a podcast. And we did.
So we did.
And here we are.
And Seth kind of, you guys lived in New York. You were in New York at the time. Yeah. And you were in New Jersey.
Yep.
And I would come to New York. I was coming to New York every week for work. And we started recording these podcasts every couple weeks, every time we had time.
And it started as an every 2-week thing. At some point, we decided weekly was a good idea.
And we question our sanity now.
We always question our sanity, let's be clear. But yeah, no, we're 600-ish episodes. This is number 600. There is no number 599 because we wanted this to be the special one. And we are counting in order. We just sometimes skip one when we need to. Yeah. So there you go.
And Ed Pizzarillo from
Miles to Go
gives us a hard time every time about our counting skills. So with that, we're going to jump into the episode and we're going to talk about Farnborough, which is an air show in the London area. And there's a lot of news that came out of Farnborough.
And yet not nearly enough. So the Farnborough Air Show is one of the 2 major air shows of the year in Europe. Every other year it alternates with the Paris Air Show. And historically, those 2 have been the center of the commercial aircraft sort of world. And that's where new things get announced. It's where you got to be there. That's where, in the room where it happens kind of thing. And they have historically succeeded at that. Over time, things have shifted. There's a Dubai Air Show, there's a Bahrain Air Show, there's a Singapore Air Show, there's a bunch in China also. The markets have shifted. And interestingly, in the last couple of years, there's been less and less actual sort of commercial aviation news at Farnborough in Paris. And this year, obviously the people who run those shows still think they're super important and are trying to hype them up, but 347 aircraft were ordered at Farnborough, were announced. And to put that in context, a couple years ago, Indigo Group, which is the airline behind Frontier, the company behind Frontier and a couple of Wizz Air and a couple others, ordered more than that in one go, in one order. So 347's kind of weak. Does it matter? Maybe it's harder to get people to show up and think that your air show is important if people aren't actually ordering planes at your air show and making big news. The other interesting thing about this year's show, SMBC, which is a lessor, one of the big leasing companies that buys airplanes and then leases them out to other manufacturers or to the airlines, is responsible for 200 of those orders. So they are responsible for, I do the math on that, 5/4. So however, 58%. of those orders. So one company basically dominated it, and they split theirs 100 from Airbus and 100 from Boeing, all single aisles. Kind of boring, but despite that, there was some interesting trends that I think are worth talking about. And so one of those is, of the SMBC orders, AerCap had some 787s, Philippine Airlines did some 787s, Bermuda Air took some A220s, and Abra Group, which is Gull and Avianca, right, did a bunch of Embraers as well. And there's some other ones, but all of them chose the bigger planes.
Well, is it possible the reduced number of planes is because the backlog is so big and all the engine problems?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes, you can't actually order a plane today. I mean, you can order a plane today, but only one of the deals included a delivery date from Boeing or Airbus, and it was a few years out. If you order a plane today, especially a single aisle, you're looking at a 2032 delivery, like especially if you're a nobody airline. If you're United, they might find a way to try to do something for you, but right, like, if you're a smaller airline, you can't get an airplane in the next 5 years.
What's the mix here then? Because in the next 5 years, you have these air shows that people are trying to hype up.
Yeah.
But you're not going to be able to order a plane and actually get it delivered. Do you see the numbers going down again for how many orders are going to happen? Let's say it's Singapore. Or
we're also due for a refresh, right? On both the MAX and the NEOs.
Like a new version?
Yeah.
And Airbus has announced their next gen single aisle. Concept is maybe in discussion. So they've committed to the idea that they think they'll have an airplane design ready to share with the market at the end of this decade.
A concept of a plan.
It's the makings of a plan.
They're building it.
We are building it. Well, we're not building it yet. We're building the plan. It's even worse. So that's actually one of the things they did. Airbus did a finance briefing in addition to the commercial stuff. And so they got all the bankers together at like 7:30 at night during Farnborough, which seems like a terrible time to do it. But they briefed, and they're one of the things was like, yeah, we're still trying to ramp up production, and everybody's trying to ramp up production still. They can't get engines fast enough, to Foz's point. The GTF engines are still troublesome, and they can't get lavatories and seats and all of the other inserts that go into planes. They claim that it's not their fault. Their production is okay. Reality suggests they're like, they just took over some of the production from Spirit AeroSystems with that whole split with Boeing buying back the 737 line. Airbus bought out its lines. Those are actually still having some trouble getting stuff timely to Airbus. But there's a lot of challenges in terms of getting the stuff built to put, you know, what we call building an airplane is the final assembly line.
Yeah.
And so it's, they get a bunch of parts all shipped in, and it's, if you do it right, everything arrives at the right time in the right place, and it just all, you know, clicks together.
But like, think about it, right? Average lifespan of an airframe is 20 to 30 years. If you're 5 years out, you're looking at 25 years at least. Do we really think we're going to be getting on A321neos in 25 years in mass?
Yes.
You still think we're going to be getting them?
I mean, in mass is a tough call, but because, you know, what is mass? But there will be more A321neos flying in 25 years than there are 757s today.
Sure.
And someone come back and hit me with that in 25 years, I'll buy you a beer if I'm wrong.
But the production rate of the 75s was much smaller than the 321s at this point. Total production.
Okay. Well, we'll have to find some ratios then.
Yes.
But we got a quarter of the total 75 still flying? Produced?
No, not even.
Yeah. So no, we won't have 10% of even the full production of 321s still flying, but we're going to be delivering 321neos 15 years from now.
Well, so here's a question that I'll pose kind of in conjunction with that. So the overall capacity of the aircraft has gone up.
Yes.
Smaller planes aren't necessarily being produced today.
Correct.
So CR2s,
CRJs are done.
CRJs are done, right? Mitsubishi owns the rights to these planes. They're not making them. E-145s, E-135s, done. What's the balance here? Because no one's going to make, maybe the Chinese manufacturers come out with a small plane. I doubt it because there's just no demand for it, but that is still a market. You're not going to start flying 737s to Manchester, New Hampshire.
Hey, a couple airlines do.
Hey, everyone's upgauging in premium.
Well, and right, but that's one of the challenges is everybody is, and the orders that we talked about, right? Like the SMBC order, they did mostly MAX 10s, not MAX 8s. They did 321s, not 320s.
These are big planes.
And they're big planes. The AerCap 787s, they officially ordered Dash 9s, but they said they're probably going to end up converting into Dash 10s. Philippine Airlines did 787-10s, and that's their regional aircraft. And it's Southeast Asia and the islands or areas around there is a little weird what they consider regional, but Singapore does the same thing, right?
Yep.
7-8-10s are their regional aircraft because it's big volume. Japan, China, sort of similar. So most of the orders are the bigger planes, and that's good in some ways, but it does create these challenges around what do you do in the smaller markets? Where do you get a 50-seater now? Where do you get a 30-seater now?
Yep.
No one's building those. United is, and Delta to an extent, are retrofitting slightly larger CRJs to become smaller seat capacity, but with first class in them, which cool. But those CRJs are also going to eventually no longer be airworthy.
It creates an interesting problem for small markets, like say outside of the Chicago metropolitan area, that
the entire Caribbean,
everywhere in Colorado, in Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota.
Yep.
Do we just go back to prop planes?
Well, I mean, that's the next thing is the eVTOLs. Like, do the eVTOLs fill that gap?
No.
Because they don't have the range? Or
they don't have the range. They don't have the size. Mm. Right now, what we're seeing for eVTOLs now, and there are some flying, and that's important to know. And there were some deals announced at Farnborough. There was some you know, bits unveiled and whatever. The main news out of Farnborough was Joby and Virgin Atlantic re-upping slash hyping a deal that had been made a long time ago, that Virgin Atlantic is going to be the exclusive UK partner for Joby. And they made a map that's like a spray pattern out of Heathrow and out of Manchester, because that's where Virgin Atlantic planes will land, to like all the other places that these eVTOLs could take you. And they're four-seaters. And yes, they can get you to Battersea very quickly, because that's where there's a heliport, but they're not going to take you to the city. They're not going to take you into the Docklands or wherever the people actually want to go. Similar-ish problem in New York. You can get a helicopter from JFK to the river in Midtown.
Yeah.
And then you got to get a car to take you the rest of the way. And there's nowhere for your bag. And.
Make Can-Am HQ great again? Helipad?
Oh. Wow.
That was a deep reference. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that was... Everybody know the Pan Am building helicopter crash? Yes? Okay. So we stopped doing helipads in New York City as a result.
Okay, so that's not an option.
I do think there'll be some growth in those planes. We may go from four-seaters to nine or maybe 19.
But it's not a CRJ.
But it's not a CRJ with a 1,000-mile range.
Yeah.
Certainly not in the next 20 years.
And we've already seen this with the airlines kind of getting rid of some of the regional service. United giving up on East Texas, American giving up on some of the smaller markets out of Dallas. It's kind of like we've just not going to put a CRJ or a E175 there.
But it's cyclical. These go away today, and they'll come back in a few years.
Yeah.
Right. This is the problem with small markets: is they get exit and then they go back,
or they'll replace it with a bus,
or they'll replace it with a bus.
I don't mind the bus services.
No, I think the bus services make a lot of sense for a lot of markets. Do they make sense for like Tyler to DFW? It's a 2-hour drive. Probably not.
It's the limits.
It's the edge of the limits. And can you do it securely? And if something happens to the bus on the way there, it's kind of, you missed your flight. So.
Right. But it's a protected connection at least. Nice. Versus me driving the 2 hours and there's a crash.
Fair. Fair point. All right. Tell me about Jet Zero.
Jet Zero, blended wing body. So this is a funky looking plane. It looks like a giant manta ray or triangle flying. With some wingtips on it. They're another one that has been, their initial model is supposed to be roughly a 767 replacement.
Okay.
So decent size capacity, with a couple hundred seats, but more range than a 321 or a MAX 10 kind of thing. It's a super interesting product. I'm a little skeptical that it really does what they think it's going to do. One of the big challenges with it is the interior, instead of being a tube, is sort of this giant triangle. And so the seating inside is, you might just be, it's like a 5-aisle airplane. So it's like the super wide, super, super wide body. And 95% of the seats don't have windows. And for me, that's super sad. But I do wonder, and I've talked to them about it, like, you know, how do you get passengers? How do you get people to get in a plane and know that, like, they can't see out what's going on and still be okay with it? Obviously the Emirates first class version with the crazy displays and synthetic windows, there are plenty of people that have decided that that's acceptable. And so not plenty, that one person or two people per 777, right? It's not a ton of people and they paid a lot of money for it. And there's other distractions too. But the other thing that people raise every time I come raise this issue that people come back with is Yes, but what's the first thing that happens when everybody gets on a plane today? Because there are screens on board that close the window shades. And I had this coming out here yesterday. Yep. A transcon, I think mine was the only window shade open. And I still couldn't see out of it because I was in 1A and it's scuff up to hell because of the jet bridge. So like, you know, I see blurry bits of America as I flew over, even with my glasses on. I'm bitter. But yeah, so that's their take and they think it'll work. Jet Zero is also working some angles trying to get government funding. They want to be competitive for the next tanker contract.
Oh, interesting.
Because the size and shape, they think they can do that pretty well and very efficiently. They also are designing the plane to sort of be plug and play with engines, so it can take any kind of engines. Like their first models are using current off the shelf engines.
Does the engine sit in the body of the plane?
It sits on top.
Okay.
At the back. So it's like, I don't know how, I don't understand entirely the aerodynamics of it, but it's like a bulb in the front and it tapers off in the back. And then the engines are sort of at the back where that taper bit is.
Yeah.
It's an interesting concept, but the seating bit, the main reason I learned that this came up again at Farnborough is that one of my stories about the seats from 3 years ago, all of a sudden hit a spike in traffic. So people are talking about it again and looking for it.
I'm always wondering, like, overhead bin space on those types of planes. I mean, they'd have to put overhead bins, I would guess.
Everywhere.
Yeah. On the plane.
5 aisles worth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They've got space for it. The other thing is, like, there's some other weird things they call for, like it's a double wide boarding door so you can board and get off the plane faster, except none of the jet bridges in the world are going to support that.
Yeah. Look how much it took to get the A380 jet bridges and things built.
And so like there's some bits about it that are really cool. I really like the concept. I would love to see something new and different to fly around with. I think there's some challenges around it. They're designing it to fit in an existing gate space. Yeah. Also.
That's interesting. And so is this more realistic than Boom?
Yes. But that's like damning with faint praise, right? We've gone from 0.0000001 to like, you could triple that, 10x it, and it's still is. No, I think it's much more practical than Boom.
Yeah, you were going to say something, Fuzz.
I don't remember what I was going to say.
Okay. Let's talk about first class on low-cost carriers.
All the rage?
All the rage. Allegiant announced it.
The final domino has fallen.
They're the last one.
They were the last one.
Frontier?
Frontier has a 2-2 coming. They've previously announced they're going to do, right, their Spirit big front seat.
Yep.
And then, and to be fair, Allegiant had first class seats or a 2-2 layout.
Yep.
I think I look up 2013 to 2017 or something like that on the 757s that went to Hawaii. They mostly needed them for pilot crew rest, and then they had a few extras since they would sell them. It was one row. So Allegiant has had some experience with it, but yes, this is the premiumization of Allegiant Airlines.
That's weird.
Is it? I mean, is it?
No, it's necessary, I think.
Yes.
Is it necessary?
Well, I think they want to compete because they want to be able to say, look, we've got first class too, or we've got a bigger seat, or we've got these amenities, so we can again segment the market.
But look at where Allegiant flies. They fly into a lot of
Idaho Falls once a week.
Airports that no one else flies to. Yeah. Do they need it?
If they can get a little extra money for that seat, I think so. What about Southwest? What's Southwest going to do about first class?
Oh, you know what? Southwest doesn't. So maybe not the last one to fall.
Though they keep talking about it.
They do.
The non-hub airline?
Sorry, I just put a picture of the Jet Zero interior up on the screen so people can see it here. I find it
wild.
Yeah. But the only ones in this picture, super interactive podcast, these are the only seats that have windows. Everything in the back half is just inside. Yeah, people were wincing in the crowd. I love it. Everything in the back half is just like you're in a box.
And you know, by the time an airline gets this, there'll only be 3 rows in the back.
Yep, there'll be 14 across instead of 8.
4-10-4.
Someone just said lie flat. The only value of that is lie flat coach would actually be comfortable again. That was the glory of the 252. Anyway, where were we? First class. Yeah, no, you're right. So Southwest doesn't, and I should have been.
They're also not a low-cost carrier, so.
Well, are any of these low-cost carriers anymore? What does low-cost carrier mean?
What does it mean? What is ultra-low-cost carrier?
Yes. I think the terms are stupid.
So how does this fit in with JetBlue? Because JetBlue's also announced F.
JetBlue announced F a while ago, or their intentions to do it. They finally confirmed the product name now is Blue First, which I don't know why we have to brand everything stupidly like that, but okay. And they're going to have a first class seat on their planes, and it's going to be fine. The Allegiant one, I do think it really comes down to there's some, I think it actually does make sense. I think it's two rows, it's eight seats. It's in a portion of the plane that already has extra leg room, so they can probably get away without removing too many seats to do it. Right. You remove the middle seats in those rows, but not you might probably don't have to remove a full row to get it. And this is the, David Neilman says the same thing about his first class on the A220s that he has, where he's doing a 2-3. That's for Breeze, where he's doing a 2-3 layout.
Yep.
And he's like, I only lose one seat, and it was the extra legroom rows anyways, and he's able to drive such higher revenue on those. And that's when, so Allegiant is doing this, the way they've initially pitched it is it's going to be a first class fare product, not a seat buy up like Big Front Seat was. So it's going to include check bags and carry on bags and things that Allegiant always charges extra for. So if they actually sell as an F, like different fare class ticket, that will be a little surprising and interesting for them because everything they sell right now is all economy with buy ups and bundles. But it still gives them, I think, access in a number of the markets. And like you joke about some of the markets they fly to. Portsmouth, New Hampshire, down the road from me is it's a big market for us, is the Allegiant operations. But they fly three or four cities, depending on the season, they go different places. A lot of what they get out of our area is second home folks. It's not, and it hasn't for a while been, but it's not just people who are like, that's the cheapest ticket I can find. It's people who live in a very small market, prefer to fly locally rather than driving the 2 hours from Tyler to DFW. And are willing to sacrifice a little bit of flexibility on the schedule, but still pay for their flights to get that convenient flight. And so there's enough people in that category who they did this Allegiant Extra thing. They launched it in 2019. COVID disrupted some of the rollout. They relaunched it in 2022, 23-ish, and it's gone gangbusters. And it's literally just a couple extra inches of leg room and a bag of garlic herb twist things that weren't very good.
So they saw that and they said, this is the entry point to getting F.
The entry point was just extra legroom. And yep. Southwest did that too now. And the next step for Allegiant and was the same thing for Frontier. They did extra legroom, then they did block middle, and then they did this. And so there's a pathway. In some ways, the surprising part is that the European carriers still haven't switched, right? They've stopped at blocked middle.
Yep.
And mostly haven't even done extra legroom.
No.
Well, the legacy carriers haven't. The low-cost carriers have, right? Your Ryanair's and Wizz Air's and EasyJet's have extra legroom. BA doesn't somehow.
But it's up for fleet flexibility.
It is fleet flexibility, yes. They can use the same plane in different places. They can sell 30 business class tickets on one flight and 10 on the return and use the same airplane to do it. And somehow people accept that it's the same shitty seat. You know, just pay more for it. I don't know. It's Europe, man. Anyway.
All right, let's talk about Dulles.
Dulles and DCA to a bit. By the way, I'm wearing my Dulles socks because we're talking about it today.
Awesome.
Dulles got an announcement for a $22 billion investment to rebuild the terminal over the next, I want to say, 8 or 9 years. I think 2034 is maybe the target.
This is just a tag on to what United was already committed to doing at Dulles.
This is someone else paying for it.
Yes and no. This is someone else managing the financing of paying for it. United had a commitment for a $7-ish billion expansion that was the new Terminal EF complex. And they've started building that. They still expect, I think some of the gates are supposed to open later this year.
Yes.
Right?
Soon, yeah.
So that's happening. The other part of it, though, is that they've now, the rendering they've got has two more giant concourses, I believe, past that. Maybe it's only one more, but it's a significant number of additional gates. They're going to connect, they're going to expand the what's currently the Z gates, the sort of main terminal, Sarian terminal area, to actually have capacity for more mainline aircraft. They're going to make it walkable from that to the AB terminal, so you don't have to take a train.
Oh, nice.
It already is.
Yeah, you can walk. You can walk train.
You can't walk to CD, but you can walk to AB.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. I've never had. Huh.
It's not easy to find, but okay. It's walkable.
But they have a big. The rendering shows a much bigger picture or a much bigger walkway now. Grand concourse kind of thing. So they're going to make that more accessible and better. Add more thing. The train. They're going to get rid of the mobile lounges. No more moon buggies at Dulles. Very sad, but also like they need to go.
But that's also the quickest way between.
Well, not when you have put in new trains, though.
So is that part of the investment? Is a totally new train system?
Part of the investment is significant expansion of the train system. And so there's still the current train is sort of like a horseshoe.
Yep.
That goes out to the ends of each of the piers and then gets back to the middle at the main building. That's going to continue. They're going to extend it out of both ends. Plus, they're going to put a just center line sort of a la Atlanta terminals connector. Honestly, the renderings look a lot like Atlanta to me.
Does anything change at C and D?
I think that goes away.
They demolish them?
So what I see in the renderings, and it's hard to tell because they're renderings and you don't know it's real, but trying to go with what buildings are where based on where they line up with runway intersections currently, that building stays somehow.
I think it's going to get replaced.
I think it gets replaced, yeah. And the renderings seem to show it as smaller planes, so maybe the CD replacement becomes the regional jet farm. It's a smaller building, but...
So it'll be right-sized, because that's really the number of people it should hold is CRJs, not 787s and 767s.
Yes, but... I think it's the dullest stuff is nice. The main problem I have with it, one of the renderings, the horseshoe line for the train goes off to infinity.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually loop around in the renderings. So I don't know where it stops, which is obviously not actually a problem, but it's still annoying to see. But they've also managed to basically create a giant, I'm calling it a sombrero, but like a hat on top of the Sarian facade. And that to me is disgusting. Like
you're sad.
I'm angry. I'm not even sad. I'm angry about it. Like we're preserving this history. We're preserving this architectural glory, and we're doing it by building such a large thing behind it that it will blend in, and you won't really see it anymore. And all to get like a bigger head house, which they probably need a little bit of additional space for check-in if they're going to keep growing. But like, you're not going to put all the lounges there. You want to put the lounges out by the gates. You're not going to put stuff there. What are you doing?
I've never had a problem with crowds at check-in at Dulles. Like, that's never been an issue. The issue is at security.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Maybe they're bringing security upstairs so you don't have to go to the basement.
That would be nice. But then I also
want to be in the basement because that's where the train is.
Whatever you did there.
Maybe. Okay, maybe I don't want to be in the basement.
Sorry, we'll have to edit that out.
I feel like
having the basement with the train, that's where I want security to be. Because then I can just hop on the train and go to the next turn.
But there's a lot of MC Eschering to get there.
That is true. Down this escalator, over to this escalator, up this escalator.
It's like Denver.
Yeah. The other part of it that is interesting is they're talking about building the largest parking garage in North America. 32,000 spaces.
But is there a need? That's the real question about Dulles.
Well, no. But
so have a train.
That's the other thing. Like, right? The Silver Line runs through Dulles now, and there's massive parking facilities like 1 to 3 stations away. You could even give people a free ticket on the Silver Line if they use those parking garages. Like, there's ways to do it.
With all the data centers, they could just build garages underneath the data centers near Dulles, and you'd be fine. Everybody could take the train into the airport. Think about that. Interstar car stays cool and snow free.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
But is there really this much demand for Dulles in the next 30, 40 years?
I don't think so.
That's the real question.
I like the crowd.
We got one vote for no from the crowd. How many people think Dulles needs to grow?
How many people fly through Dulles?
Okay, so the people who still fly through Dulles regularly, you want it bigger?
One. We got one.
And he's waving his hand in the maybe section. Okay. So we're going to go with maybe we don't need... All airports need to grow at this point, especially hubs. That's one of the challenges, again, going back to bigger airplanes and everything. Like, even if you're just keeping the same number of planes there, there's more people. Air travel is going to, whether we like it or not, air travel is going to continue to grow.
I'd have used this money to bury the turnpike by Newark and build a runway on top of that.
But then you have to get rid of the docks.
That's true.
That's not going to happen.
Yeah,
I know. I understand.
I still think they should just close the turnpike for landings and then rope it in. Reopen it.
The Gibraltar of Newark? I could get behind that. We'd have to take down all the light posts, though.
United's helped with that.
One at a time. So that's the giant parking garage is kind of absurd to me. But, we'll see what actually comes of all of this. This is another one of the things. And you're talking about who's paying for it. right now, the main thing is that the feds are going to issue the bond, or not the feds, the MWAA, the municipality, the government is going to issue the bonds to get this paid for. The good news about that is they are, because it's a government organization, they are considered more stable and more likely to pay it back. So the rates on those bonds are lower, the interest rates.
Yeah.
And so the cost, long-term cost for the construction, because someone, you pay back those bonds by landing fees that the airlines then pay back to the airport as rent. And there's passenger employment costs. Currently, I think Dulles is in like the $12 to $15 range, if I remember correctly from what I'm reading. There's concerns that this construction project sextuples that up into like the high 70s to 90.
Wow.
Over the next decade. And like, I know inflation's bad, but that ain't cool.
But is that economically feasible, right? Because that's why Continental left Denver.
And why United has fought having to pay for the construction themselves. And there's not enough other airlines that are going to pay with passengers. It could get ugly if these, especially like why you're building a 30,000 space parking garage.
So, I mean, I think it also raises the question of like where Dulles fits in strategically for United, because to me, it's always seemed like a reliever hub, not like
it's a bastard stepchild. Just look at the planes they put there.
Yeah. I mean, it's all 767s and
Old 737s, and this is Ed's biggest problem.
Yeah. Ed Pizzero.
Yeah. And yet, it's also the gateway for long haul to DC.
Agreed. It's interesting where it fits in, because if Denver has problems, because Denver is like storm ridden, right? In the summer, it's a very hard airport to fly into.
Yep.
And you add Newark to that, Dulles always comes out getting that traffic, because people get diverted or rerouted through Dulles and they end up flying through there anyway. And it's like, could you make that a bigger hub to actually hold the traffic?
Or this week we saw them going to Chicago and Cleveland.
Oh, Cleveland became a hublet again. All right. So on that topic, I want to talk about United and Houston, because they announced they're going to put a bunch of their new 787s in Houston to serve markets.
The 78Ps, I believe.
The new
IJ. The fancy one with the first class, whatever.
The studio.
So they're going to serve Heathrow, Sao Paulo, Narita, and Sydney.
Heathrow starts in January. The other three start with the winter season in October.
And Sydney makes some sense, because it's already weight restricted, right, to fly the 787s to Sydney. So now they have fewer people on the plane. Kind of makes sense. I find Heathrow to be a little interesting out of there, because they currently fly like two a day on 777s. It's not always full.
But BA is their competition.
And it has a better product.
Yep.
And I could see that Heathrow in general is just going to become the premium. That's more of a Heathrow gets the 78Ps, not Houston gets the 78Ps.
So then they can rotate the plane through.
Yeah. And everywhere we'll start to see more 78Ps on all the Heathrow service, I would guess.
Sao Paulo? What do you think about that one?
That makes sense to me. That's a premium market.
Most surprising to me.
Most surprising? Or even over Narita?
Yes.
And why are you not surprised by Narita?
Narita will end up being your rotation at some point.
So they're using that plane for like LA or something.
Or Newark or something.
Yeah.
Right. To work through the system. Sao Paulo, you probably won't see that.
I mean, it comes back to the same. Go ahead.
Like the only reason I'm a little surprised at Sao Paulo is utilization, because the planes sit for 12 hours.
But the counterpoint to that is they have a maintenance base in Sao Paulo now. So that might be part of the thought process.
Yeah.
They'll do like Dulles, Sao Paulo, or Chicago, Sao Paulo on one of these as well.
I'd say Newark first.
Really?
Yeah.
I guess it makes sense, because we'll have the plane there. Narita surprises me, just because the traffic that goes through Narita is typically connecting in Narita. It's not ending. It's not. They haven't started Houston Haneda. They let ANA handle that traffic.
But from Houston, it's probably not just connecting, because they don't have a Haneda flight.
So do you think it's like all the South America, Latin America feed going to Narita, and that's their option is Narita?
Probably a lot of it.
Yeah. Makes sense. New longest flight.
Yes. We continue to ride the Project Sunrise media hype train.
We get suckered in.
I dislike it and remain impressed at how well they're doing it. Airbus last week operated the A350-1000 ULR from Toulouse to Melbourne.
Yep.
And then from Melbourne back to Toulouse.
Over the United States.
Over the United States. So imagine you fly Melbourne to LA, and then LA to London, and then another 3 hours down into France. It was a 24-hour, 24-minute flight. And somehow people think that like the 20 plus hour flights nonstop from Sydney and Melbourne to London and New York are going to be a good idea. And it's just, right? We've talked about this a little bit. We've all done the very long Singapore Airlines flights.
I haven't.
You haven't done it yet?
I'm doing it next in 2 weeks.
All right. Hope you make it home. For those of you who don't know, Stephen, that their ticket home might have some war implications.
Details.
It's a long flight. It's nice in business class, though, because you got room, you can spread out, you can take a nap, you can lay down, all those things. The fact that they're putting, as comfortable as they want to make it, there's still economy seats in the back of that plane. And I just don't know how someone's going to do 22 hours nonstop.
They're starting with Sydney to Heathrow.
Correct.
That's the first one. And then Sydney to JFK will be the next one.
Eventually, when they get more planes. And
how are they serving JFK today? Is it simply through the Auckland flight? Auckland,
I believe that's the only one they have.
So they got, because they got rid of the LAX to JFK flight.
Correct.
Because they pushed that over to AA.
Well, I mean, AA always had LA.
No, but they pushed that traffic
right
over to AA to get them to LA or Dallas.
So my question is there actually a market for...
Qantas is convinced that there is enough of a premium demand market that people will pay for this.
Also, it's 230 seats.
So what's the...
It's a very small... You need to sell a lot of them, but if it's a couple hundred seats a day in a market that serves, 1,000 to 1,500 people, and right there, the overall markets for Sydney, London, I think it's probably bigger than Sydney, New York. I'm guessing at that. I don't know for sure. But
we have Sirium.
Sirium doesn't do good with international.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. But it's you only need a small chunk of that market. And the interesting statistics I saw from Qantas, and obviously they're trying to juice the numbers in their favor, was about how they, when they launched Perth to London, they saw a significant uptick in traffic and in premium traffic and in higher yields than any of their other markets. They were able to get more money out of passengers at a faster rate than any of their other markets. So they look at that and they're like, yeah, the numbers work.
That's them. Yeah.
But that's like a 3-4 hour difference in flight times though.
Shorter?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Perth is, that could be the tipping point though.
We will have to see.
No.
I mean, I'm still concerned about ETOPS and just the long haul nature of it. Seems like you're going to end up with some diversions to places like Mali or Diego Garcia or random spots because.
Sure.
You're like, that's a benefit.
Think of the line, Stephen. Think of the lines.
It'd be like when Air New Zealand started JFK Auckland.
Oh, yeah.
Where it was every other day, it was diverting.
Oh, yeah. We're in Pago Pago today or whatever. Yeah. For those who don't know, ETOPS is engines turn or people swim. So it's the rating of the plane and how far it can fly on a single engine. And because it's a twin engine plane, the ETOPS rating has to be fairly high for this ULR.
Yeah. I mean, there's different ratings based on the number of minutes from a diversion airport that you can be, it's the aircraft equipment and operational capabilities of the airline, and the planning and everything they do. There's some extra equipment involved. It's a complex thing. And that Stephen's version of it is obviously the funnier version. It was then extended twin engine operations, and now it's just extended operations or something like that. They've changed it again because it's not only twin engine
planes that have to meet that.
It's anything flying so far that you might be. There's an ETOPS 300 now or 330, which is you can be 5 hours from a diversion airport, which is insane to think about the fact that like an engine might fail. You might have to descend and then fly for 5 hours to get to an emergency runway. I would not want to be the pilots involved in that.
No.
I'm actually vaguely okay being the passenger involved in that because you'd assume they'd keep serving the alcohol. But,
sir, do you understand what's happening?
Yes, I do. That's why I need more. Keep them coming until we hit the ground.
That's all the topics. Is there anything else you guys wanted to talk about?
We got a whole bunch of questions that have come in on the little app for...
So we're going to save that for the Patreon.
We're going to save that for the Patreon bit, but I think we've hit... Is there anything else before we move on that you all want to talk about that we didn't get?
Or want to know about us before we go into the Patreon section? No?
I want to know what line you're most excited to get that you have not gotten yet.
What line are you most excited to get that you have not gotten yet?
Will Foz go first?
I have no idea. I haven't even thought about this.
I mean, I'm excited to do Newark, Singapore.
Yeah.
And it'd probably be the only time I ever do it.
I think certainly of things I have booked right now, the one I'm most excited for is Bangkok, Vienna, which in some ways doesn't really sound all that interesting. It's just, I go from Asia back to Europe and it's cool. I booked it on Ava, the Taiwan-based airline. And there's a very long history with respect to that route going back decades. And it has to do with the getting service into Austria from Southeast Asia, and also the aircraft that were long-haul aircraft not being able to get nonstop from Taiwan into Europe without stopping somewhere in Southeast Asia, because they would have to overfly China, mainland China, to make that work. And so the history of that one is pretty cool to me. And so I've got that booked for November.
Now you got to think of one.
Dallas, Fiji, if we can make that work.
We got like 6 weeks.
September 5th.
Yeah, that's not going to happen for me for months. I'll book it, but I'll cancel it.
On brand.
And on that note, have we flown COMAC?
I had it booked and couldn't make it work. So I haven't flown it yet.
I have not.
I have flown the ARJ, what is now the C909, but was called the ARJ21 at the time, right? That's the MD-80 stubby knockoff that they built, the first plane. I did that a couple years ago. It's probably 10 now, out of Chengdu. It's actually one of the interesting fun things about flying in China is, like, I booked based on where that plane was. I was like, okay, like type in the airport codes and go for it. I'm like, I don't know where I'm landing. It's this town I've never heard of, and it's a 7 million person town that I've literally never heard of and don't know where it is in the country. And then there's a high-speed train from there to Shanghai, which is where I needed to get to. So I was going to try to bring the microphone out, and let's see if it attacks when I do this.
Hi, thank you. Are any of you status chasers, or are you just booking whatever you want, however you want?
I think he permanently chased status. So he's now Global Services with United for Life. So do you chase any other status?
I would say Alaska and attempting Air Canada.
Why Air Canada? Explain that one.
Air Canada, if you can get to Super Elite, the priority awards are really, really, really lucrative. So a priority award will basically give you 50% off any award. You earn them at each tier, but the tier that you earn it at determines what you can use it for. So when you hit Super Elite, you can use it for anything globally, including Emirates. So it becomes an accessible way to get to Emirates.
Seth?
So it includes partner awards, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I do not. And I say that with an asterisk on it. I got United Million Miler a while ago, so I've had that shortly after the merger when the numbers came together. I worked to make sure I finished that off. It was one of the Widerow Germany fairs is how I finished that off. So for those who know,
how many did you do?
I actually only just needed the one, but it was a last minute, like 2 weeks out. I was like, sorry, honey, I'm going to the Christmas markets this weekend, and disappeared from my wife for a weekend. But it was cool. Like, told the flight attendants, you know, I was celebrating as I went across. They gave me the pilot sign and gave me the paper charts. It was a neat little small celebration, but it was fun for me. And I say no, I have historically slightly chased JetBlue Mosaic status. Being based in New York and then in Boston, they are one of the largest operators in both. They have a lot of nonstops places I go, and it's gotten a little less, but the value of the Mosaic, even when they added the extra tiers, the base Mosaic One status was, you know, free changes, free seat assignments, some things like that, was valuable to me. I did the 25 for 25 challenge, which I know a couple of people here have done. That's right. That gets me the next 25 years of it. And I actually have had it since they started it. So I will, you know, for the next 25 years, be one of the few people that has had it for the entirety of its existence. 25 years from now, if JetBlue still exists and if Mosaic still exists and I have to think about requalifying, I can't promise that I will chase it. But what was the other bet I made about 25 years from now? The 321s?
The 321.
Yeah, if they're still flying 321 Neos in volume, you can count me in.
I guess I chase Alaska status now, mostly, just being based here. I have Million Miler with United. I'm about 200,000 miles from 2 Million Miler. I just haven't been able to bring myself to fly United 200,000 miles. So,
yeah. And to answer the question more broadly, I think having some status is always nice. In many cases now for me, the amount that I'd have to pay to get the status, usually, and my schedule is super flexible in most cases, other than, like, I have to be in Portland this weekend, I have a couple conferences I have to go to. I don't have to be somewhere all the time. And so I can, you know, poke around and find the fare that, you know, premium economy fare that I can upgrade, or even just, you know, deal with premium economy across the ocean or things like that. And I go where the tickets are cheaper. And so that makes the status a little less valuable to chase. If you're going, if you're flying for work and you need to have that flexibility and whatever, or the, you know, the consistency and those benefits, there's absolutely reason to do it. But don't do it just because you like having the wallet candy. Do it because it makes sense for what your actual travel patterns are, because you're paying for that free breakfast.
It's not even wallet candy anymore.
They don't give you your wallet. I know.
All right, let's wrap it up here and then we'll go to the Patreon supporters. So thanks, guys. Patreon supporters, keep on listening. You'll hear some questions and Q&A when we're going out. Thanks for listening. Happy travels.
Take care.
And thanks, PTE.
BTF.
BTF.